Welcome to Profiles. I'm Steve Sanders. On this edition, we meet someone who has helped to shape the legal educations, directly or indirectly, of thousands of law students and attorneys, and who's also helped to shape the legal curriculum. When he steps down this summer to return to writing and teaching, Alfred C. Amen, Jr. will have served 11 years as Dean of the Indiana University School of Law at Bloomington. Fred Amen, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you, Steve. Happy to be here.
Like many successful people, you've had a number of important mentors in your career. But let's start with the very first one. This person wasn't a lawyer, wasn't a judge, but he does provide some insight into your other great passion besides the law. We're talking about the legendary drummer Cozy Cole. How did you come to meet him?
Oh, when I was very young, I was taking drum lessons in Rochester, New York. And a friend of our family knew about Cozy and knew what a wonderful player he was, but he also knew that Cozy had a school. It was called the Cozy Cole Gene Krupa School of Drumming in New York City. And this person, whose name was Claire Moldenhauer, took me, a couple of other youngsters from the neighborhood which I grew up in, and my uncle to New York City. Mm-hmm. I must have been, I'm guessing, I don't know, 9 years old or so. Mm-hmm. And then specifically, he took us there to see the Yankees play baseball and to see New York. It was my first time on an airplane. It was a very exciting trip. But he also wanted to take me to the Metropole Cafe to introduce me to Cozy Cole. Mm-hmm. Which he did. Mm-hmm. And I met Cozy, and he said, you know, someday I hope you can come to my school. Mm-hmm. So I wrote him, and therein began a relationship mm-hmm. with him.
And you studied with him for how many years? Oh. We should back up and say you grew up in Rochester, New York. You were playing the drums since the age of?
Four.
Of four. Okay. Yeah. And then you did later study with Cozy.
I did. I started when I was around 9 or 10, and I probably continued it for really 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. My aunt used to take me, because when I was so young, I mean, I needed someone to help me out. My aunt used to take me from Rochester by train mm-hmm. To New York City, and we had a routine down. There was a midnight train that left Rochester at Friday midnight, and we would take that train. We would arrive in New York City at 8 o'clock Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. As a little guy, I mean, it was so exciting. I would go out to breakfast and tromp the streets of New York, mm-hmm. And then from 2 to 5 in the afternoon would be my lesson with Cozy Cole. Mm-hmm. And I would have lessons with Cozy when he was in town, because he was on the road quite a bit. And when he was in town, he was usually playing in New York. And usually then the Metropole Cafe was quite a wonderful jazz club. And Dizzy Gillespie was often there, Gene Krupa, mm-hmm. Cozy Cole, a lot of the great players. So the lesson would go from 2 to 5. We would then have dinner, and we would go catch the first set at the Metropole. And Cozy would always play the lesson for me. When his first solo came, no matter what the tune, no matter what the tempo, he managed to work in whatever it was that we were working on.
Knowing you were listening in the audience.
Yes. And of course, it would just completely astonish me that it could sound so good, because in the lesson I was having such a hard time with it. But when you hear it all put together mm-hmm. and you hear it in the context of a great band and a great player like he was, mm-hmm. It was very exciting.
One of his great hits, something that was very significant to you, is a selection called Topsy Part 2.
Yes.
There was a Topsy Part 1 and a Turvy Part 1 and a Turvy Part 2.
But Topsy Part 2 was a terrific hit, one of those gold record kinds of hits. And it was wonderful for him. I mean, Cozy Cole is historically an extraordinarily important drummer. A major, major figure in the swing era of drumming, and had played with Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong, plus a host of other bands, had been in movies, but always, I mean, a serious jazz player. And it was fun, really, to see him break into the commercial side of things mm-hmm. for this brief moment and have the notoriety that he really deserved as the artist that he was. Mm-hmm. And Topsy was, at the top of the charts for a long time, I think in the late 50s, early 60s.
Joe Bourne, the jazz host here at WFIU, has been kind enough to dig out a recording of Topsy Part 2. And so let's play that. Let's listen to this piece that was very influential for Cozy Cole and for you.
Yeah, great.
Topsy Part 2.
While that was playing here in the studio, Fred, I could see you tapping your foot, and it was all you could do to keep from doing a riff with your pen there, I think. If there had been a set of drums, you would have been at them here in the studio while that was playing.
It was wonderful to hear that again. Cozy plays with such played with such a feel. Anytime, anything he played, he would just have the whole room swinging, the whole room dancing. Someone once said, I think it may have been Wallace Stevens, music is feeling and not sound. Mm-hmm. And Cozy played with such feeling and such swing. It's wonderful. The other thing you hear in his playing is a narrative. He takes a simple pattern and builds on it, mm-hmm. and embellishes it slightly, but there's a theme. And then when the band comes back in, the call and response between the drums and the band really integrates the drums so beautifully into the whole musical setting. He was mm-hmm. he was a very, very musical drummer, mm-hmm. And tells a story. Mm-hmm. I mean, his drumming is very narrative, very musical, and always has a kind of storyline to it mm-hmm. that you could follow.
Right. And obviously a very significant influence on you. You later went on to study at Oscar Peterson's Music School in Toronto. You received a Downbeat scholarship, Downbeat magazine scholarship, and appeared on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, among other things. For your undergraduate work, you studied at the University of Rochester, which allowed you to both major in political science and to take classes at the Eastman School of Music, a very good, very distinguished, nationally known school of music. But at some point, you had to choose, and law won out over music. Why?
Yeah. I developed and had very, very strong interests in other areas, too. I was the first person in my family to go to college, and I don't know whether that's cause and effect or not, but somehow when I got to college, it was like, you know, the proverbial kid in the candy store. And I just loved it and got extremely interested and involved in the courses that I took, political science, philosophy. Those were very important disciplines and courses for me. And so when I gave thought to what I wanted to do after college, I knew I loved music. I knew I would always play music. I knew I would always stay with it. But I also wanted to follow some of my other intellectual interests, and law school was a natural mm-hmm. for me.
Okay. In your senior year, you were nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship, a very prestigious honor. And because of all those music classes that you were taking over at Eastman, there was a little confusion during your interview for the Rhodes Scholarship.
Yeah, it's a neat story. I think at the University of Rochester at that time, there was in the philosophy department the great philosopher Louis Beck, one of the great Kant scholars of all time, really. And though I had taken a lot of philosophy courses, I never did take one from Professor Beck, but from others. But I did take a number of courses at Eastman in the music school. And when I was interviewing for the scholarship, one of the people on the committee said, my goodness, you've taken all of these perception courses with Professor Beck, and you've made an A in every one of them. That's extraordinary. And I said, well, these weren't perception courses. These were actually percussion courses. And it wasn't Louis Beck. It was John Beck, who was the percussion professor at Eastman. Mm-hmm. And I was happy to make an A in those classes, but it wasn't straight A's with Louis Beck. But they let me continue.
The committee
anyway.
Was so duly impressed. You did go on to study law on a scholarship to the University of Chicago, one of the great law schools yes. at that time, and certainly still one of the most distinguished law schools in the country. Yeah. At Chicago, you were an editor on the Law Review, ultimately the executive editor of the Law Review, right. and you actually played a small role in helping to launch the career of a person who's regarded today as one of the most influential judges and legal scholars in America.
Well, I think that's a bit of an overstatement. I don't think I launched anything as a typical law student relating to a brand new professor. I and our other editors of the University of Chicago Law Review one day got an article from a new professor on the faculty. This new professor's name was Richard Posner, and the piece was called The Federal Trade Commission. And so, you know, this first of all, this is some new young professor, and was he worthy of respect? Of course he was, but we had to express ourselves, you know. And we passed the article around, and I remember saying something like, gee, the Federal Trade Commission, what a dull title. Why didn't he entitle it What I Did With My Summer Vacation or something like that, you know. We weren't so bad, though, as to begin to realize after we read the piece that something new was going on in this article. And it really was the beginnings of the law and economics movement, approach, analytical methodology that Richard Posner was so instrumental in bringing to the law. We were smart enough to publish the piece.
and Posner is today a professor at the University of Chicago, as well as a judge on the Court of Appeals that sits in Chicago, the Seventh Circuit.
That's right. And I should tell you that as I tell this story, I actually told it again when I had the honor of introducing him as our Harris lecturer a few years ago at the law school. Mm-hmm. And I think he got a little bit of a kick out of the fact that one of his former students and editors, you know, just what went on behind the scenes mm-hmm. When a professor gives student editors one of their articles.
Mm-hmm. After law school, as many outstanding young lawyers do, you clerked for another federal judge, in this case Albert Tuttle, who was a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. You've written about the kind of man Judge Tuttle was. You talk about his courage and independence of mind, his compassion and integrity. And you've written that for someone who knew Judge Tuttle, it became difficult, if not impossible, to be cynical. This was clearly somebody who had a profound influence on you.
An enormous influence. When I was in law school, I knew that I wanted to apply for judicial clerkships. I thought that this would be a very interesting thing to do after law school. And it is, in the way the profession works, usually the only time to do it is right after you graduate. And unless lightning strikes and you become a judge yourself, you never see the legal world through that window. So I really wanted to see the legal world through that window. And I applied to judges whose opinions inspired me. And also who sat in parts of the country that I'd never been to before.
Mm-hmm. This was the South.
Yeah, in those old days, it's now been split into the 5th and the 11th, but in at that time it was Texas to Florida. Mm-hmm. So it was Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Florida, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And Tuttle was the chief judge, and he had just stepped down, but he stepped down to create an opening so that they could get another judge on the court, but he continued to carry his full load. He didn't interview his clerks. He just called me up one afternoon and said, you know, I don't interview my clerks, but your record looks very interesting to me. And if you'd like to come, please do. At the time, I was one of my professors, Owen Fiss, who was then at the University of Chicago. Professor Fiss had just joined the faculty having litigated a number of civil rights cases throughout the South. So I went to Professor Fiss's office and I said, I just got a call from a Judge Tuttle and he's offered me a job. And what do you think I should do? And there are certain points in one's career where you get unequivocal, great advice. Mm. Fiss stood up from his desk and he said, Judge Tuttle just called you? I said, he did? And he said, if you don't leave my office immediately, go back to your room, call the judge, and accept that offer, you will be making the biggest mistake of your life. I'll never forget it. So I went back. I accepted it. And the judge said, he said, oh, you know, take a day or two. It's okay. I said, no, judge, I'm coming.
I've gotten advice, and, yeah, and this was it.
He was a great, great, great man and a great, great judge. His qualities as a person, as a human being, really poured into his qualities as a judge. His integrity, his ability to see the law in a deep way and how it evolves and how it grows was so important, because Tuttle was responsible for some of the most important civil rights cases and judgments, which then went up to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Now, the Supreme Court was put in the position of affirming what the local Southern judges were saying, not reversing them and mm-hmm. imposing their will from Washington on the mm-hmm. South, but rather agreeing with the judges from the South mm-hmm. on such important issues as the segregation that existed and the fact that the courts knocked out, mm-hmm. in effect, apartheid mm-hmm. in the South. And Tuttle wrote, along with other judges in the Fifth Circuit, wrote these wonderful and important opinions that the Supreme Court could then simply affirm and embellish on. Really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And powerful opinions overturning many practices that were common in the South and upholding civil rights.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know, the judge, though Atlanta, he always said, and it's true, Atlanta is a very cosmopolitan city now and certainly and even was back then too. But the judge had his fair share of threats and unnerving kinds of phone calls and things like that, which never seemed to bother him.
Mm-hmm. Now, at one point, while you were working for him, your two worlds, music and law, converged. You brought Cozy Cole to the judge's office, and he did something, and he gave you a piece of advice about the relationship between drumming and legal work.
Yeah. Cozy Cole, as it turns out, was touring with Jonah Jones. And one day I open up the newspaper and I saw that Jonah Jones was going to be at the Hyatt Regency featuring Cozy Cole on drums. So at this point, I'd been a little out of touch with Cozy. We exchanged letters along the way, but it had been a year or two and I hadn't heard from him. And so I show up the first night in the club and, well, it was old homecoming and it was so great to see a friend and a teacher. He was there the whole week and we spent a lot of time together. And one of the days, I asked him to come by the office so I could show him the courtroom and the office. And unfortunately, Judge Tuttle was out of town that week, and that was too bad because I would have loved to have these two people know each other. They would have enjoyed each other very much. But Cozy went around the judge's desk, and it had, you know, a big leather chair in the back and a gavel. And I'll never forget, he picked up the gavel and laid down a riff on the judge's desk with that gavel, like, you know, like I'd never heard before. And it was very, very funny. But we talked a little bit, and Cozy said, you know, he said, I think I could have been a really good trial lawyer. And I said, how so? He said, because I bet that the really good trial lawyers are wonderful at telling a story that connects with other people, that they can understand how a person got from A to B, and that if you could communicate that story, you could be very effective. And I think that's, by the way, very true in terms of the ability of trial lawyers to connect with juries. And as I mentioned earlier, if you listen to the way Cozy plays the drums, he is the master storyteller and narrative. He you're hooked. Mm-hmm. As soon as he starts playing a line, you can kind of sense where it's going, but you really he takes you step by step. And in many ways, I think he had that kind of talent and saw a relationship between music and law, which I think is very real.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break and go to another piece of music now that is part of your past. This actually, though, takes us back to your days not as a drummer but as an arranger. Is that correct? It's a
That's
piece
right.
called Yesterdays.
That's
this
right.
was done while you were a student?
Yes. I think I was a junior in college at that time, and there was a summer course at Eastman called the Arranger's Workshop. One not only took the course and wrote arrangements for purposes of the course, but what was wonderful about this course is that you knew that your real test was writing for a show that would occur at the end of the course, usually in August, at Eastman Theater. And there was often a star headliner. The year that I did it, Carmen McRae was the headliner. I didn't write for Carmen McRae, but I did get a chance to write an arrangement that was featured at that concert. And it was a tremendous experience and a great educational experience that taught me a lot about teaching and taught me a lot of things which I think are relevant to the legal world.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so something from a tape from your collection, something never before heard on radio.
No.
Yesterday's featuring Fred Amon as arranger.
And one, two, three, four.
Recording made when our guest, Fred Amon on Profiles, was a student arranger at the Eastman School of Music of a piece called Yesterdays. Fred, we left off with your days as a law student, a law clerk. You practiced law for a while in Atlanta and in Washington, D.C. And before coming to IU, you taught for many years at another fine law school, Cornell, as a member of the faculty there after practicing. While you're at Cornell, you continued to develop your thinking about what you argued was a close relationship between studying music and learning law. And one of the things you said in an article and in a speech you gave was that there's both more intellectual structure in music than many people appreciate and more emotion involved in learning the law than many people appreciate.
Yes, I think that the creative process is a very important part of being a great lawyer. However, and it's obviously a very important part of being a musician. Many times people overlook the fact that in music, before you get to the creative process, you really have to have a deep understanding of the structure of the music that you're playing. You really have to have your technique well established. And when the technique is there and it is literally in your fingers so that it's second nature, you're so much freer with your own imagination and creativity. As one of my piano teachers once pointed out to me, I had wasted my finest feelings on the wrong notes. And this, I never forgot, has the importance of having the two together, you know, the technique and then the imagination and the feeling. And similarly in law, I think that one needs to understand deeply the structures, the technique of the law, the precedents, the processes, the methodologies, the different interpretive approaches, the different roles that institutions play, courts, legislatures, the executive branch, the private sector. And then you can help society through your client shape the ways in which that law evolves, hopefully in a way that is humane and creative and open to the kinds of changes that flow through our society on a regular basis. And I think the training and the opportunities that I had in music, I found really applied quite nicely in my teaching in law school.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about how also this gave you insights into the role of law clinics, places in law schools where students actually get to put into practice in real-life situations under the supervision of an attorney, things that they're learning in the classroom.
That's right. One of the clinical courses that I taught when I was at Cornell was a death penalty seminar in which we took on a couple of cases every year involving death row inmates. And it was very, I think, important public service to do. But in terms of teaching and working with our students, it quickly became apparent to them that, first of all, it was necessary that they be highly critical, that they be able to critique arguments, that they be able to tell when you had a bad argument, what was a bad one, what was a good one. But the creative process was putting something together that would work, that there is something in the student role in which you become very adept at, and that is spotting the flaws in logic, spotting the holes, pointing out why something doesn't work, why this may not fly, what the flaws are. But when you have to perform, whether it's walking out on the stage at Eastman Theater or walking in front of a panel of judges at the Seventh Circuit or perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court or the Indiana Court of Appeals or the Indiana Supreme Court, you have to put together creatively an argument that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and some prospect of succeeding. It's a different cast of mind. It's a more creative, positive process that clearly involves critique, but then after critique, you have to then create. And it's that process that I found music very helpful in preparing me for law teaching. Also, I might add that this Arranger's Holiday, one of the great things about the class there was we would write our arrangements, they were played, and the next morning in class, we would listen to them. And Rayburn Wright, who was the teacher then, could stop the tape and say, gee, this worked, this didn't work, what could we have done better, what could you have done better? And clinical, and also so-called traditional classroom teaching in law also has elements of that too. These are all opportunities to kind of stop in our tracks and to say, well, wait a minute, why did that argument work? Why didn't it work? How are we going to come up with something that will achieve our goal with this particular judge in this particular case? And by the way, you're going to be in court tomorrow afternoon. That's also very important. There is always a timeline here that focuses the mind.
Mm-hmm. You came to IU in 1991 to be dean. What attracted you to IU, or what were your initial impressions of IU and Bloomington?
Well, I was very attracted. I was very interested in what I would call a university-oriented law school. And these are law schools that clearly are professional schools, clearly are preparing their students to be good practicing lawyers, but do it in a way that recognize the importance of the broad liberal arts in thinking about law, thinking about its history, its the trends, where it's going, how it's put together, how it could be put together in other ways, how you could effectuate change. And I think law schools that are connected to the rest of the university intellectually, that bring to bear history, political science, economics, philosophy, and all the lenses that those disciplines can provide to the study of law, are exciting places intellectually. And secondly, I think prepare students extremely well for the long careers that they're going to have in the law. And IU is such a place, and the thought of being a dean at a place where I could help and facilitate the bridge building that goes on between the law school and other parts of campus and the law school and other universities throughout the world has just been a terrific opportunity for me and something that I've enjoyed enormously.
And you were, when you were interviewed for the position, your interviewers didn't consist solely of law professors and senior administrators.
No, I mean, clearly I talked with all of them and then at the end of the day, and it was a long day, very enjoyable, but a long day, they said, oh, there's one more interview. And they took me over to the music school and I interviewed with David Baker. By the way, therein began a friendship which continues to this day. David, of course, knew and was good friends with Cozy Cole. My teacher at the Oscar Peterson School was Ed Thigpen, who was a close personal friend I know of David's. And so we had a great time talking music, and I realized that that may have been the most important interview I had all day.
And you've said that maybe half jokingly, half seriously, that the dean of the music school, Gwen Richards, has offered you a cross appointment when you stepped down as dean, as professor of law and music.
I'm sort of pushing for this, but I don't know if it will materialize. But I certainly that would be a Walter Mitty like dream of mine.
Probably the first such cross appointment in academic history. You have on your office wall a marvelous picture of you and the former Attorney General of the United States, Janet Reno, sharing what looks like a very hearty laugh when she visited the law school some years ago to participate in commencement. But there was actually some tension around that visit, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. As it turns out, the Attorney General came to our graduation 10 days after the Oklahoma bombing. Mm-hmm. And really at that point, no one knew for sure whether this was one terrible, tragic event or was the beginning of a series of such events, mm-hmm. number one. And number two, the Attorney General was the focus of a lot of attention that grew out of that event. Mm-hmm. We didn't know whether she would come at that point. The fact is, our graduation was the first time that she left Washington. Mm-hmm. She left Washington and came, and normally would travel with very little security, but was forced under those circumstances to travel with a great deal of security. Mm-hmm. And we weren't quite sure who would be in the audience. We weren't sure whether there would be militia men mm-hmm. Coming from other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. There were certainly suggestions and faxes that suggested that that might occur.
There were actual threats, really.
Yeah, and really nothing materialized. There were some demonstrators, but they exercised their First Amendment rights as they could do and did do, and they did so appropriately in a protected place near the auditorium, but didn't interrupt the proceedings within the auditorium. Mm-hmm. And as the graduation proceeded, there was a good release of tension because you realized that the whole event was going to go through normally mm-hmm. without anything untoward. Interestingly enough, I remember very well, so many of the students came across the stage that day, students who had young families, mm-hmm. all came across the stage as they were graduating with their little ones in hand. So the whole event had a very warm, joyous feeling to it. So it was a very important and interesting event, but also one which I think turned out to be so much easier mm-hmm. than we had thought. Mm-hmm.
Of course, entertaining important figures from law and politics is one of the perks of being a law school dean. You've had many important judges, including two Supreme Court justices who have visited IU during your 11 years as dean, visited the law school. And even with someone like the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, it's not always about business, is it?
No. And interestingly enough, we had developed an approach to Supreme Court justices, you know, they don't like to sit on cases that have issues in front of them that might conceivably come before them in an actual case. And if they're put in those kinds of situations, they usually avoid saying anything interesting at all, and it's not very good. So we devised a historical moot court, the question being, I suppose, did Richard III really – was he really responsible for the murder of the princes in the Tower? And we put together a record and put together a moot court that focused on that historical question, which, of course, no one could think would come before them in a real case. But then there was one other thing that became important for the chief, and that is, if at all possible, he'd like this moot court to occur during football season. And would it be possible to see a football game? Well, as luck would have it, Penn State was in town that weekend, and I got to take the Chief Justice to the Penn State game, which I can tell you was a rather long game if you were an IU fan.
But it gave you lots of face time with the Chief
Justice.
Lots
of face time, and there was a point when the game was no longer in question, shall we say, and we had a nice long conversation. But it was a lot of fun, and mm-hmm. he had fun, good. And that was what was important. And similarly, when Justice Ginsburg came a couple of years ago, she also came to preside at a historical moot court involving Custer and whether or not Custer, had he survived, whether or not he should have been court-martialed for his actions. And that, too, created a very interesting historical moot court. Mm-hmm. Both of them were covered by C-SPAN and broadcast a number of times as well, I'm happy to say. It was good for the law school and nice to get that kind of visibility.
And despite your responsibilities as dean, you've continued to be very actively engaged with music. You play on a regular basis here in Bloomington with a group?
I do. I try to lead a balanced life. I've been playing with a group called the Carl Sturbaum Quartet. And Carl and I are lawyers. And Rick Heater and Gary Potter come from the music mm-hmm. school. We've had a wonderful time together. I enjoy their music enormously, and I'm happy I have a chance to mm-hmm. to play with them.
And although, unfortunately, there aren't yet any extant recordings of the Carl Sturbaum group playing, we're going to listen now to a recording of that you made with another group that you played in when you were at Cornell, teaching at Cornell, a piece called The Greenhouse Effect.
Yes, and this band was started by a group of undergraduates. The leader of the group came to me one day, said that he had heard I'd played drums. They were putting together a group that played bebop, and they would like to have somebody in the group who actually lived it.
Okay, let's listen. Dean Amen, when you step down this summer, you will have served as dean for 11 years, spent a time of great accomplishment for the law school as measured by things like endowments and faculty appointments. But there seem to be two key themes that you've emphasized. One, something you elaborated on earlier, expanding partnerships and interdisciplinary studies, connections with other academic units in the university. The other one is globalization. You really think that lawyers and legal education need to have a more global perspective.
Yes, I think that I always say to my students, I think this is one of the most interesting times to be going to law school because we are just beginning to come to grips with and to learn how to live in a more global world, a more global society than ever before. The interconnections between ourselves and others in other parts of the world have increased enormously with computers and communications of all sorts. Business is done in a very different way now in many areas than it once was. Capital moves freely around the world with little or no agency of the state in most cases. An extraordinary number of things like this that I think really require a new perspective on not only international law but domestic law as well. Globalization is a bit of a buzzword. It means a lot of different things in different contexts. I don't think it's a day or night kind of thing, but I do think it's like a quarter click on the dial, which puts everything a little bit out of focus unless you understand the fact that boundary lines don't mean quite the same anymore. Territory doesn't mean quite the same anymore. States remain extremely important, but perhaps not as important in the economic sense as they once did. Our ability to take our environmental pulse scientifically now makes it easier for us to see the environmental implications of ozone depletion, global warming, acid rain, things of that nature. Mm. All of these things, I think, require law to keep pace and law and lawyers to prepare themselves for a world in which the local and the global collapse often.
And this is something that it seems that business has understood, that political scientists have understood, but lawyers, you believe, have been a little bit late coming to.
Well, I don't know if they're late coming to it. I think that law sometimes lags these changes, but I'm not sure anyone fully grasps the significance of the kinds of changes that are going on, in part because so many of them don't involve states or structures or the kinds of hierarchies that we are used to dealing with. So many groups can form for both positive and negative reasons, as we've seen on the negative side through terrorism, across boundary lines in ways that have no relationship to pre-established institutions or structures. And some of the positive things need to be institutionalized a bit more, but not rigidified. And similarly, we need as a world to come to grips with some of the externalities of globalization, poverty, certainly the terrorism that we've witnessed. These are all issues that now require more interdependence and more partnerships between the public and the private sector and between and among different states and different governmental entities.
Mm-hmm. Fred Amon, when you return to teaching and writing, you'll be helping us to understand these phenomenon shedding further light on them. For now, I want to thank you for being our guest on Profiles.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
For Dean Fred Amon, for WFIU, I'm Steve Sanders. Thank you. This has been Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in February of 2002. Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Pascash. Luann Johnson, research assistant. For WFIU, thanks for listening.